The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. I return again today to the double issue of Time, published for March 29/April 5, 2021. It has the red border of Time. It has a white large Time written in block prints superimposed over the tropical themed portrait of a young tan woman with long black hair, and she's surrounded by tropical flowers. This is the issue I've been reading from for the last couple of weeks. Let's see who did that portrait on the cover. It is by Amanda Fingbada Pakaya, an artist based in Brooklyn, who says, "I still believe in our city." Going now to the first article entitled "A Vanishing Border: Why Colombia Opened Its Arms to Venezuelan Refugees." Photographs by Fabiola Ferrero for Time and written by Carl Vick. The first photo seen behind the title is that of a river. It's a muddy river, a shallow river. One sees rocks appearing from beneath the surface. Lots of willowy kinds of plants surrounding the water on the banks, and in the background, rolling mountains. I was going to say they're low, but they may be higher in the distance based upon the perspective of the lens. This is under the subtitle World. Another photo here of a building in Bogota houses Venezuelan migrants. Occupants who are desperately in need of food place red fabric in their windows. Well, this looks like an apartment block. It's part gray concrete, part red brick, at least three stories tall. The lens is focusing on windows. There are windows to be seen, each of which has 3, 6, 9 panes. They're rather horizontal in structure. Some have blue and white paisley curtains. Some have white curtains. Some have knotted up blue curtains. Some have long draped blue curtains pushed to one side with one window open, and something or someone is peering out of it. The window above that is curtained in white, but it has the red cloth knotted to something on the outside of the window frame that indicates a need of food. More windows with white and red curtains on them. For the first few miles, the emptying of Venezuela is a visible thing. Crossing the border from their benighted native land, refugees trudge uphill into the next country, Colombia, carrying what they have. "There are certain roads where you can see them," says Fabiola Ferrero, who spent years photographing what Colombians call los caminantes, the walkers. A motorist might pass hundreds on the highway to Pamplona, a city on the Colombian side of the border, and then they disperse to the rest of the country, Ferrero says, of an exodus so steady and absent geopolitical drama, it's largely escaped the rest of the world's attention. Yet 5.5 million people have poured out of Venezuela since 2015. Almost as many as the 6.6 million people who have fled Syria over the course of a decade. Almost all arrive hungry. Venezuela has collapsed, not as a result of war, but under a failed economy run by the incompetent yet tenacious regime of President Nicolas Maduro. The country has both the world's largest oil reserves and a third of its population facing hunger. Small wonder that as many as one-fifth of Venezuelans have sought help elsewhere. The largest share, estimated at up to 1.8 million, are in Colombia, which shares with Venezuela a 1,400-mile border, a similar culture, and history of hospitality. During their country's decades-long civil war, Colombians were the ones seeking refuge. Many found it in Venezuela, including the great uncle of Colombia President Iván Duque. That's spelled D-U-Q-U-E. I remember how he drove me around Caracas and explained where the Colombian neighborhoods were, Duque told Time in a March 9 video interview. I got to understand that in times of crisis in the 20th century, Venezuela became home for many Colombians. That history figured in Duque's decision, announced February 8 to give Venezuelans formal leave to remain in Colombia. What Duque calls temporary protected status, TPS, allows a migrant to live as a native with an ID card, health coverage, and Social Security for at least 10 years. As a gesture, it is at least as generous as Angela Merkel's 2015 decision to welcome 1 million migrants into Germany, though Colombia, with an economy one-tenth the size, is taking in twice as many people, and perhaps many more. We could see 10 million people out of that country within 2 or 3 years if Maduro remains in power, Duque said. It's humanitarian, it's fraternal, the president says of his decision. We are also sending a message to the world that you do not have to be rich to do the right thing. Not many nations do. 7 decades after fleeing Israeli forces, Palestinians in neighboring Lebanon need special permission to work. In the U.S., Donald Trump upended a bipartisan tradition of extending TPS to migrants from countries affected by disasters. And though Venezuelans were welcomed in some Latin American countries earlier in the crisis, others have thrown up obstacles. There's a very small map here, very primitive looking. South of the Caribbean Sea lies Venezuela, with much of its coastline on the Caribbean Sea. Caracas is its capital. Just to the southeast, also with ocean frontage, is Colombia. Bogota is its capital. Pamplona is a border city in Colombia, very near Venezuela. And south of Venezuela, then, to the east, is Brazil. Ferrero notes that even in Colombia, a friendly country in general, better than the rest, migrants encounter resentment and presumptions of criminal intent. When I interview them, they say, I don't know why they treat me like that, or call me Beneco, V-E-N-E-C-O, which is a derogatory word for Venezuelans. Oh, there are a couple more photos here in a very dark room. Very dark room, but with windows, half of which are draped with dark fabric curtains. Seated on a bed is Henrixi Sanchez, who arrived in Colombia just in time for lockdown. Sometimes we eat once a day, she says. She's barely visible in this very dark photo, at least for me. And then in another photo, and these are full page, these two, it is not so dark. It shows dark wood cabinetry with a blue-painted wall and a window, with no drapes on it at the moment at least. The caption reads, in an apartment with no refrigerator, Sanchez's boyfriend, that must be the boyfriend of the woman in the preceding photo, Sanchez's boyfriend, Angel Correa, stores food where he can. Well, there's a TV here. It's a portable TV, kind of a large Samsung portable TV, on top of which are a couple of baseball caps. The TV's unplugged because there are cords hanging down in front of the screen. And the TV is on something that one might consider a nightstand. It's a square, blockish-looking piece of furniture in dark wood, or perhaps it's fake wood, with 3 drawers. And the bottom drawer is open, and in it are vegetables, potatoes, peppers, onions. That's the pantry for this little apartment. Back to the derogatory word for Venezuelans, which was in the preceding paragraph spelled Veneco, V-E-N-E-C-O. Ferrero is herself Venezuelan, and resides now in the Colombian capital, Bogota, after arriving just before the border was closed to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in March 2020. Lockdown hit migrants hard. Many could no longer afford the $5 daily rent for shelter in cities like Bogota. I interviewed one guy who went out to get something to eat or work. When he came back, they closed the door and took all of his stuff as payment. Ferrero also passed out notebooks so migrants could log their meals. They came back. Breakfast, nothing. Lunch, nothing. Dinner, potatoes, Ferrero reports, for days and days and days. In the ultimate measure of desperation, thousands returned to Venezuela, only to circle back again. Colombia's government is stretched, too. Duque says it spent nearly $1 billion a year on the migrants and has been shortchanged by donor nations. The international community has committed over $20 billion to support Syrian refugees, compared with $1.4 billion for almost as many Venezuelans. Duque wants more help but calls TPS a win-win solution that vests migrants in Colombia's economy and takes pressure off its health care and social services. It also sets an example. Duque's move was applauded even by news media in Latin American countries where right-wing governments have moved against migrants. If all the Latin American nations had a political class similar to that of Colombia, the continent would have a different destiny, the famed Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa wrote in Chile's La Tercera. And March 8, 1 month after Duque's announcement fulfilling a campaign promise, President Joseph Biden granted TPS to the estimated 320,000 Venezuelans in the U.S., fulfilling one of his own. So Colombia started and the U.S. follows, says a smiling Duque. And then we expect other countries to do the same. This has reporting by Ciara Nugent and Madeline Roach of London, and the primary writer of the article was Carl Vick. Identity, Learning to Embrace My Family's Differences Too, by Naima Koster. The first name is spelled N-A-I-M-A, last name C-O-S-T-E-R, and that person is the author of the novel What's Mine and Yours. When my husband and I first moved to North Carolina, we were invited to join an interracial couples group at our church. We were surprised, declined, and then privately rolled our eyes at how we had been misread. Although I am black and my husband is not, we did not see ourselves as interracial. We're both Latinx and identify as people of color. In our families, our lineages are complex. Questions of how our people identify are sticky, and answers shift with time and context. I know siblings who identify as different races, although they share the same parents. My own parents were both Latinx and Caribbean, but only my father identified as black. While my mother had black ancestors, to say she was black was not quite true to either how she identified or how she moved through the U.S., and yet their differences seemed more significant to outsiders than to them. They were used to familiar bonds existing across lines of color. The places they came from, the Dominican Republic, Cuba, and Curaçao, were distinct but also kindred. All this is to say my husband and I had precedent. We assumed that to be interracial was to be different, divided, which was not how we felt. Still, there was something dishonest, avoidant about the way I had scoffed at our invitation to the couples group. I was quick to say that we did not have the same issues to work through that the other couples might, and I was right. We had our own. The first time we traveled back to the U.S. from a visit to Colombia, I was questioned heavily at customs. What did I do for a living? What was the purpose of my trip? Where had I gone and why? With whom? It was only after it was over that my husband said, "I've never been asked so many questions coming back from Colombia in my life." Immediately, I started to cry. I had grown up watching my father be harassed by airport personnel. I grew to expect it, but I never stopped feeling angry and scared. I identified powerfully with him. Although people often told us we looked nothing alike, I'm lighter skinned and have benefited from the associated privileges. Now that I was the one who could count on being stopped, I wondered if it had been lonely for him, too. I believe connection is more than shared identity, but I've still found it difficult to resist seeing myself as the same as those closest to me. I have felt this impulse especially in contexts where I already was an outsider to whiteness, in my private high school where I bonded with the girls of color in my class, in the black spaces I called home at Yale, in my family of origin and my chosen family. I felt it when as a child I picked out the crayons that I thought most closely resembled my skin tone and my father's, and felt great relief that they were at least both brown. The desire to belong to the people we love is powerful. It can be tempting to elide differences and emphasize similarities. I am black like my father, Latinx like my husband. But this urge to focus on commonality is akin to the sort of reductive thinking that's so troubling in public conversations about race. Those conversations are often marked by easy categorization. Although how race and culture shape identity, kinship, and solidarity are much more complicated. When I was pregnant, my husband and I spoke often about how these questions of identity might get trickier with a child. We focused mainly on how my husband could support the experience of a child we imagined would be brown. To our surprise, our daughter was born with light skin and green eyes. Strangers and relatives alike declared she looked nothing like me. They were speaking about appearance, but their words suggested something more elemental about who she is, who I am, and the gap between. My daughter's a toddler now, and occasionally someone will say she has my eyebrows, my under-eye circles, my nose. Mostly people continue to insist we look nothing alike. I know what else they mean. I don't know how she'll identify when she's older. I imagine it will be complicated. My hope is that I'll let it be so. I hope we remember we do not have to make a case for how alike we are to be kindred. We do not even have to be kindred to love one another. Are they hurting the climate? Critics say NFTs are an energy-guzzling threat to the planet. By Alejandro de la Garza. This is a short column, and interestingly, it's printed in black ink on a sky blue background rather than the usual white background of the pages throughout the magazine. At the bottom, there's a photo which looks kind of altered to me, but anyway, it's in almost an electric blue. The floor is electric blue, the sides, the walls are electric blue, and by the way, the walls look more to me like a whole series of small post office boxes. The ceiling's electric blue, and at the very end, there's an electric blue figure, or at least the outline of a figure of a man in an electric blue suit walking toward the end of this corridor that is bright green. The caption reads, "A cryptocurrency mining operation in Cuiabamba, Romania, January 22. De La Garza writes, "In central Washington state, electric utilities are watching for homes with oddly high power usage. After a recent surge in cryptocurrency prices collided with a boom in NFTs, an emerging technology that uses crypto platforms to authenticate ownership of digital files. During the last crypto boom, the region, home to some of the cheapest power in the U.S., was beset with a new energy-hungry home industry, basements and sheds, loaded with racks of computers, churning through advanced mathematical calculations in order to mine valuable crypto coins like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But even small crypto mines can overload local grids, making them a problem for energy companies. Far larger cryptocurrency mines have been set up from Texas to Iran to China's Inner Mongolia. While NFTs hold promise, critics say the mining that makes them possible is perhaps humanity's most direct way of making money by polluting the planet. Ethereum, that's spelled E-T-H-E-R-E-U-M, mining consumes about 26.5 terawatt hours of electricity a year, almost as much as the entire country of Ireland. In theory, all mining energy could come from renewable sources. But right now, there's money to be made by essentially converting cheap fossil fuels into valuable cryptocurrencies. This is just heartbreaking in so many aspects, says Camilo Mora, a professor of geography and environment at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. That may surprise artists and other NFT fans who are far removed from the technology's environmental toll. You do not see your money as going to a miner who's going to pay for fossil fuel-based energy with it, says Alex DeVries, a financial economist. Some in the crypto world are working on solutions. Ethereum's developers promise to launch a less energy-intensive approach by 2022. But cryptocurrencies are popular in part because they're decentralized, which attracts people who distrust governments. That means there is no single leader who could force a change. It is pretty much guaranteed that miners will continue to run Ethereum in its current form, says DeVries. So what I described as rows of post office boxes are computers on racks. The View, subtitled Economy, Are We About to Pop? By Zachary Karabell, that's K-A-R-A-B-E-L-L. Bubbles, bubbles everywhere, so say an increasing number of Wall Street professionals who see the lofty prices of everything from equities to Bitcoin, new homes to the soaring value of newly public companies, as clear signs the financial system is again on the verge of a major reset similar to what happened in 2000 and 2008. But is it true? The fact that stocks have run up in aggregate 80% since they dived in the first weeks of the pandemic in March 2020, or that Bitcoin has gone up nearly tenfold, or that Tesla has soared almost eight times over to become bigger than the next nine global automakers combined by market cap, certainly should force everyone to ask the bubble question, as should the nearly $20 trillion that global governments have spent to shore up economies devastated by pandemic disruptions. And then there's the SPAC phenomena, which is a complicated vehicle to bring private companies public that is seeing a multi-billion dollar frenzy. I mean, Shaq has a SPAC. I suppose it's pronounced SPAC because it's preceded by an A. This is the capital SPAC term. What could go wrong, quipped one bubble-watching economist recently. Asset soaring, however, is not in and of itself a sign of a bubble. Since the dot-com crash of 2000, bubble hunting's become its own cottage industry. If there's any doubt about the veracity of that statement, just look at Google's Ngram, which traces usage of printed words. The use of terms such as stock bubble and stock market bubble soared after 2000, crested in 2005, then receded, but still has stayed at levels never seen since 2000. calling bubbles, predicting them and warning of them has almost become a bubble itself. But that also means that almost all of these predictions have been wrong. The past month saw some wild selling and lots of volatility, as both the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 indices at times gave up their gains for the year. That led to a fair share of I-told-you-sos by those bears who'd been predicting doom. But the selling was triggered, as it often is, not by any swift change in the fundamentals of companies, but by a shift in expectations reflected in rising interest rates. Stocks sold off not because of negative economic news and expectations, but because of very positive ones, that the pandemic would soon be in the past, that trillions more in federal spending would bolster those ailing the most, and that consumers would soon unleash an orgy of spending, driving up prices and inflation. There's still good reason to question whether any of that portends bubbles about to burst. First, even if the bubble hunters are onto something, timing matters. If you had listened to former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan in 1998, warning of irrational exuberance and sold your stocks, you would have missed massive gains. The word bubble assumes speculative mania, and that is not at all evident just now. There may be pockets of that in those shack SPACs. Perhaps the recent frenzy surrounding GameStop was also a signal of froth. Stock markets, however, represent 4,000 or so companies, the vast majority of which are the cream of the crop. Most companies in the markets are growing far more than any national economy, and if you want your investments to grow, hitching a ride with companies that are thriving makes more sense than investing in government bonds. Another reason to be skeptical of bubble mania is that so many people are so certain we're in a bubble simply because stocks have gone up. Skepticism, let alone pessimism, is almost the opposite of euphoria. Even the wealthy have been keeping an unusually large amount of cash on hand, which is itself a sign of uncertainty. Finally, we have seen in the past few years rapid sell-offs that act like mini bubble bursts. Tesla, that high-flying stock, soared in 2020 and then saw its stock plunge. Peloton similarly experienced a big drop. Moves of 20% to 30% in a short time span are more common. The result is that we may be witnessing a continual formation and popping of mini bubbles all the time, which does not fit narratives of huge market moves. It is possible that by the time you read this, everything will have changed. The resilience of financial markets in a weird time, however, is unlikely to change much. For now, the only evident bubble in the markets is the sheer number of people predicting bubbles about to burst. The author, Zachary Corabel, has a forthcoming book, Inside Money, Brown Brothers Harriman and the American Way of Power. Here's a column with a trio of very short items. Short reads, warning signs, the U.S. and China are on a collision course, write Elliot Ackerman and Time contributor Admiral James Stavridis, retired, authors of 2034, 2034, a novel of the next world war. Collectively, we have to imagine the disaster of a possible war between the U.S. and China so we can reverse engineer and prevent it. 2034, a novel of the next world war. Caring for our young, Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, who first introduced the child tax credit 18 years ago, says Congress should make it permanent. 1 year of a refundable tax credit, particularly while the economic ground is still shaky, falls far short of providing a stable foundation for the future. And the third, a calmer existence. Michaeline Duclef, author of Hunt, Gather, Parent, was constantly arguing with her 2-year-old Then she learned what she calls the TEAM, T-E-A-M, method of parenting. Arguing and negotiating with children is so common in my home that I thought it was a universal practice worldwide. But that idea couldn't be further from the truth. Here's the page with seven questions. It features Don Lemon, L-E-M-O-N, the CNN anchor, and his new book, This is the Fire, The End of White Supremacy, and his hero, James Baldwin. Seven questions. There's a photograph here. It's a portrait, really, of a very neatly dressed and groomed youngish man of color. He has very short black hair, neatly sculpted around his forehead, straight across. He's smiling slightly. He's wearing what looks like a lightweight, worsted, double-breasted jacket suit with a very light-colored shirt, perhaps white or cream, and a patterned tie, darker than the color of the suit, which I'm guessing is either gray or light tan or taupe, or light blue, it could be. Question, why is this book, his book is This is the Fire, a social commentary about racism now? Answer, I just didn't want to write a book that was about Trump that in some way capitalized on what he was doing. Every day in the news, I was covering what he was doing. And that was enough of a release for me to be able to get it off my chest. But there wasn't enough of a release for the indignities that we saw George Floyd suffer on camera, and what we were finding out about the details of Breonna Taylor, and about what happened in Charlottesville. Question, your book references James Baldwin, beginning with the title's allusion to the fire next time. That's a bold choice. Answer. James Baldwin is my hero. I relate to him. He's a black man who happened to be gay living in America. And so this book was really an ode to Baldwin. I'm not trying to be Baldwin. No one can be Baldwin. But he was the first author that opened my eyes. Question, you wrote this is a time to have a point of view, not just an opinion as a journalist. Why? Answer, I have always said that everyone has a lens through which they view the world. So I am a black man who came from the South who's gay. And to pretend those qualities do not exist, I think, is doing a disservice not only to yourself, but the people you're trying to serve as a journalist. And so I think it is important to tell people what's the lens you're viewing the world from, and then have them understand it. Question, you write about how the sudden loss of your sister rendered you less hopeful. In what ways? Answer, I think what you are seeing in me is a sense of urgency that I have realized more than I had before the death of my sister, is that there's an urgency of now. And that is what I am experiencing, that life can be over in a second. George Floyd's life can be over in a second. Ahmaud Arbery's life can be over in a second. Breonna Taylor's life can be over in a second. And unless we tackle this thing now, it will continue to go on. Question, you say we're witnessing the death throes of white supremacy. Why? Answer, I think when you see a group of insurrectionists enter the U.S. Capitol, try to overturn an election that they've been told was stolen from them by black people in big urban areas of the country, I think that's the ultimate sign of fear, because they know that this is pretty much the end for them. That does not mean that it's going to happen over a year. Question, is it inevitable? Answer, imagine if you're used to being the preeminent voice and all of a sudden you're not that. You're in fear that you're not going to have the best access to everything. Be heard first, make the most money, have the most power. That's going to change just from demographics. Question, you compared Trump to a symptom alerting internal disease. What is the diagnosis Trump reveals? Answer, He's a clinical symptom of a white male patriarchy. He's a clinical symptom of white supremacy. He's the clinical symptom of bigotry. He's the clinical symptom of everything that's wrong with America. Question: one of your prescriptions is to put an end to timorous calls to get back to normal. Why? Answer: the U.S. was never great. It was always seeking a more perfect union. It was never perfect. I think there has to be a partnership between people who disagree with each other as citizens and as Americans. But I also think that we need to speak to each other very clearly, very forcefully, and get our point of view across, because if it does not happen now, it is never going to happen. We're just going to keep tiptoeing and tiptoeing until we fall off the cliff. The seven questions, as you may have noticed, were really eight in this column, which was written by Janelle Ross. Under Music, The Many Lives of Demi Lovato. First name is spelled D-E-M-I, last name L-O-V-A-T-O. This is written by Stephanie Zakarik, and there is a photo here of an attractive, long, dark-haired woman. That is, her hair is long and dark. She's seated, so one doesn't know how tall she is. She's dressed in a dark blue outfit, seated in a beige chair. She has her head tipped slightly. She has large brown eyes, and her head is tipped slightly into her left hand, while her right hand is resting on the chair. Both hands show either henna drawings or imprints or tattoos, and there's a large arch-shaped window in the background, inset in a brown wall, outside of which are green trees or plants. In the YouTube documentary, Demi Lovato, Dancing with the Devil, the 28-year-old singer and actor speaks openly about her battles with eating disorders and drug addiction, focusing most acutely on the 2018 overdose that nearly killed her. But the most revelatory words in the film belong to a selection of her fans, young women with makeup so precise and polished they look as if they're suspended in a world smoothed out by an Instagram filter. One nearly runs out of breath as the words tumble out. I love what she does for young girls and her music. It just saved my life. Another beams. I don't think she really understands how much of an impact she has on her fans. That kind of idolatry would weigh heavily on anyone's shoulders, and Lovato, a veteran of child beauty pageants who was working in television by age 7, carries it responsibly. In Dancing with the Devil, directed by Michael D. Ratner, Lovato is straightforward in discussing addiction and recovery. I am not going to pretend like I'm invincible, she says, though her immaculately undone hair and daytime smoky eyes, not to mention her talon-like glamour nails, suggest that just living up to being Demi Lovato is all-consuming. There's a veneer of professionalism to everything Lovato does and says in Dancing with the Devil, not out of dishonesty or evasion, but perhaps because she knows how many young people hang on her every word. Many of her fans have been with her since she starred in the Disney Channel's 2008 film Camp Rock, or perhaps even since her stint on the children's TV series Barney and Friends. When you grow up in the public eye, what does it even mean to have a private self? As with another performer who grew up in the Disney spotlight, Britney Spears, the subject of framing Britney Spears, a recent episode of an FX docuseries that detailed the pop star's fight to wrest control over her money and her life, Lovato's transition into adulthood has been rocky. A clip from the 2008 American Music Awards shows a television host asking her, with aggressive jocularity, how she's able to write songs about romantic suffering. How much heartbreak can you have at 16? This clip appears in the documentary, just after Lovato has revealed to us that her first sexual experience as a teenager was rape. a non-consensual act with no repercussions for the perpetrator. Lovato also states that she was sexually assaulted by the man who supplied her with drugs on the night of her overdose. Sexual abuse, exhausting touring schedules, pressure from childhood to look or behave a certain way, the knowledge that employees are relying on you, possibly to support a family, any of those things could cause even a strong person to buckle. Life is fluid and I'm fluid, Lovato says toward the documentary's end, referring not just to her ongoing recovery, but probably to her sexuality as well. Last year, Lovato was briefly engaged to actor Max Ehrich, though in Dancing with the Devil, she says she's too queer to marry a man right now. In the documentary's final moments, she also has her dark, glossy tresses cut into a short bob. As the clippers buzz in close, her hair falls away in heavy, symbolic chunks. As a result of her overdose, Lovato suffered a heart attack and three strokes. She is now, she says, on her ninth life, and Dancing with the Devil shows her on the edge of a springboard rather than a cliff. Freed from those mermaid waves, the hairstyle of choice of countless 50-ish moms, Lovato looks freer and younger, less like a matron in training. By the film's end, she seems more like a teenager than most teenagers, ready to build a new self from the old one she barely got the chance to know. Demi Lovato, Dancing with the Devil, has been airing on YouTube since March 23. Time Off Books, a quarantine bookshelf. A year into the pandemic, readers know more than ever the act of picking up a book can be transformative. When lockdown orders swept the U.S. beginning in March 2020, many turned to books to help escape or confront the unknown. Some readers favored light distraction, while others flocked to narratives that tackled pandemics head-on. Virtual book clubs kept readers connected, and rallying cries to support independent bookstores echoed around the internet. While we were confined to our homes, books kept us going and allowed us to discover new worlds without going anywhere. To reflect on a year of reading in isolation, Time asked 9 fan favorite authors to share the books that have brightened their days, provoked them, or simply helped them carry through. By Annabelle Gutterman. Perhaps I'll not read all 9. I'll skip through and read a few. Charles Yu, Y.U., the National Book Award-winning author of Interior Chinatown, chose Kurt Anderson's Fantasyland, a comprehensive examination of fake news and the post-truth world. I listened to it first as an audiobook during the early days of the pandemic while taking long walks around the empty streets of my neighborhood. It provides context, history, and insight as to how we arrived at this age of misinformation and delusion. Between COVID denial and election fraud conspiracies, I found Anderson's analysis to be essential in a difficult and confusing year. Casey McQuiston, the author of Red, White, and Royal Blue and the forthcoming novel, One Last Stop, turned to Tamsin Muir's epic fantasy, Gideon the Ninth, the first in a trilogy about a teen orphan navigating a haunted solar system. My quarantine would not have been the same without the hilarious and masterfully irreverent Gideon the Ninth and its brain-breaking sequel, Harrow the Ninth, which dragged me out of a reading slump with one beefy sword arm. These books reminded me it was still possible to love something so hard that it's all I want to think about for weeks, even in the thick of it all. Emma Straub, S-T-R-A-U-B. The bookseller and author of novels like All Adults Here and The Vacationers selected Carson Ellis's picture book, In the Half Room, an imaginative look at what happens when a room is no longer whole. All parents of young children know the truth, which is that no matter what book you're reading for pleasure, you read and reread and reread picture books 1,000 more times a day. My favorite picture book of the year, and therefore really my favorite book of the year, is In the Half Room by Carson Ellis, which is as classic and off-kilter as any good Margaret Wise Brown, author of Good Night Moon. It's a perfect bedtime book, which is the hour when you know you've made it through one more time. Kevin Kwan, KWAN, the author of Crazy Rich Asians and Sex and Vanity, chose Sandy Tan's forthcoming novel, Lurkers, that's L-U-R-K-E-R-S, an ensemble drama following the residents of one Los Angeles neighborhood. Lurkers, Sandy Tan's brilliant new novel, was an amazing gift during this year of so much loss. Tan's riveting storytelling opens a portal into the private lives of a diverse and remarkable cast of characters, each of whom is audacious, bizarre, hilarious, and all too human in ways that reminded me of the tenderness and beauty to be found in unexpected places and the preciousness of every life lived. And the final excerpt is that of Emily St. John Mandel, M-A-N-D-E-L. While many readers turn to Mandel's pandemic-centric novel, Station 11, the author herself found comfort in Monkey Beach, Eden Robinson's story of a teenage girl who sets out searching for answers in the wake of her brother's disappearance. I very rarely reread books, but I've read Monkey Beach 3 times. The book connects me with a happier time because, of course, I remember reading it before the pandemic. Also, the book is set in British Columbia, which is where I'm from. My family is still there. Because of the pandemic, I have not seen them in 15 months. Reading a book set in that landscape is a strange kind of solace. Under the heading Nation, Crime Unleashed. Thieves are capitalizing on the demand for pandemic pups, by Melissa Chan, C-H-A-N. For years, Roosevelt Rodriguez and his dog Chanel had a routine. The Houston heating technician would get home from work, swing open his front door, and greet his French bulldog, who would spin and dance in excitement as he repeated her name over and over again. Then Rodriguez would quickly change out of his work clothes while Chanel sat by the open front door, waiting for him to come outside with her. But February 22, when Rodriguez stepped out of his house to walk the 25-pound dog with the cream-colored face, his yard was empty. Puzzlement turned to panic when an elderly neighbor waved him down and uttered 5 words. "Someone just snatched your dog." "It hit me hard," said Rodriguez, 30. "I did not want to believe it." It is the reality many animal lovers are facing, as a surge in pandemic pet adoptions offers opportunities for criminals to seize on nationwide demand and shelter shortages. More pets, particularly small and easy-to-grab breeds and puppies, are being stolen and resold by thieves eager to prey on petless people's desires for animal companionship. It has gotten progressively worse, says Karen Tarquin, a private investigator in Nebraska who specializes in missing pets. Calls to her small agency by people needing help finding French bulldogs, an expensive and highly coveted breed, have increased 60-70% in the past 18 months. Averaging 3 to 5 requests a week. Not only are pets yanked from yards, cars, and stores, but those in high demand are targeted in home invasions and armed robberies on the street. People will see a French bulldog in someone's window and just break into the house, says Craig Braisman, who owns a private investigation firm in Atlanta. It's very unnerving. January 5, Sarah Vorhaus, 30, was walking her 2 dogs in San Francisco around 6 p.m. when three men approached her. One of them, who was holding a gun, punched her in the face multiple times, police said. The group fled with her French bulldog, Chloe. Vorhouse, left bleeding and screaming at the top of her lungs, believes the assailants may have been targeting six-month-old Chloe because they did not touch her eight-year-old Shiba Inu. French bulldogs can cost up to $10,000 and are a favorite among celebrities, including Lady Gaga, whose dog walker was shot and seriously wounded February 24 in Hollywood by gunmen who made off with her two French bulldogs. The attack prompted warnings from prominent animal groups, including the American Kennel Club, of potential dog-napping crimes. March 3, the nonprofit AdoptAPet.com issued an emergency alert, cautioning of a rise in pet thefts by brazen thieves. Criminals are definitely getting a lot bolder now, investigator Tarquin says. That's not surprising given the millions of people left jobless as a result of COVID-19 and the uptick in violent crime in cities across the country, says Robert D'Andrea, whose shepherd mix puppy was stolen at gunpoint by three men in Venice, California, February 27. It's more a statement on the society we exist in right now rather than an individual person, says D'Andrea, 24. People have turned to desperate measures. In the UK, dog thefts increased 170% from 2019 to 2020, according to Dog Lost, which works to reunite lost dogs with their owners. So far in 2021, at least 106 dogs have been reported stolen, compared with 55 by this time last year, says Karen Harding, the group's police liaison. It is more difficult to track pet theft patterns in the U.S., where no major advocacy group or law enforcement agency collects data. The American Kennel Club and AdoptAPet.com say their evidence of an increase is anecdotal, but pet detectives, both amateur and professional, say there's been an obvious rise in the past year. Because pets are lawfully viewed as personal property nationwide, people who steal them have relatively little to lose. Pet thefts are mostly considered misdemeanors, and the punishment similar to the consequences of stealing someone's couch. It varies by state, but if the perpetrator has no prior criminal history, the penalty is typically a small fine and often little to no jail time. In Connecticut, somebody who steals a pet or even kills one would not face more than a $1,000 fine or more than 6 months in prison. It's even less strict in Michigan, which punishes dog nappers with fines as low as $50 and no more than a year in jail, on the off chance they're caught, charged, and convicted. That leaves the risk for criminals to go up and steal somebody's dog off their property is so low that it's just profitable, Tarquin says. You'll have more luck if somebody stole a stereo out of your car than if they stole your dog out of your backyard. That leaves pet owners with few options beyond hiring detectives offering huge rewards, hoping for the best. Vorhouse's initial $8,000 reward for Chloe has grown to $20,000. In an Instagram post announcing the larger reward, Vorhouse said she would give up the money with no questions asked. "Please, I beg you," she wrote, "come forward and we will pay." A spokesperson for the San Francisco Police Department says the investigation is active but has not yielded any arrests or new updates. Following widespread attention by the media and police on Lady Gaga's case, as well as the singer's offer of a $500,000 reward, her dogs, Koji and Gustav, were recovered safely 2 days after they were stolen. Los Angeles police said they did not know if the reward had been paid. In Houston, any shred of optimism that Roosevelt Rodriguez once had about finding Chanel's nearly gone. For 2 weeks, he monitored the Internet, including Craigslist, for signs that someone might be trying to sell her. But he came to a grim realization. At first glance, Chanel may look like a puppy, but she's nearly five, and criminals know they won't profit much by selling an older dog. I'm starting to conclude that may not happen, says a defeated Rodriguez. At this point, he can only pray that whoever took Chanel will love her the way he does, and that wherever she is not scared. Rodriguez is haunted by his mistake of leaving the door open and not getting Chanel microchipped, and he's reminded of his errors each time he comes home from work to a silent home. Instead of seeing his smiling dog at the front door, he scrolls through old videos and photos of her on his phone. There's nothing, he says, that makes him feel the same way Chanel did. Rodriguez is holding on to her toys, including her favorite squeaky hot dog, in case she comes back tomorrow or a year from now. He has no plans to get another dog. Chanel, with her comically big smile, is irreplaceable. That article, Crime Unleashed, by Melissa Chan, was slightly abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.